But we can turn it around. But will we turn it around in time so we have a planet that is healthy and stable? Well, that's a good question, because nothing has happened in Washington to lead us out of the abyss. I am thrilled to have my next guest join me. I wasn't sure if we had him till a few minutes ago. His name is Joseph Rome, and if you don't know about his blog site called The Climate Progress, you're going to by the end of this interview. It is the must-read. I go there daily. He puts out just up to a minute what's going on scientifically, politically. We talked well, he was talking. Actually, I was listening, and so we're about 700-800 others in Nashville. He was one of the keynote speakers talking about messaging, how we talk about climate change to a public that sometimes seems like they don't want to hear. Hear no evil, see no evil, and yet it's pretty hard to ignore. Climate legislation, while stalled, is in the news, and we're going to talk about what happened or didn't happen yesterday when President Obama met with legislators on that, and also with the what I call oil kill, continuing unabated. I think we're at day 67 or 68 with no end in sight. Maybe some relief wells will be drilled and will work, but not till August. So there's a connection, by the way, between what's going on in the Gulf, our addiction to oil, and climate change running amok. So we're going to find out all about that and more with Joseph Rome. Welcome to the Green Front, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You were rocking up there. I was so excited. When you asked the audience how many of you know about my blog, and I don't know, maybe 10-20% raised their hand, I was up in the rafters, so I couldn't quite see. But you turned a lot of people onto your work, which is really exciting, because you really cover things very thoroughly. And I love your boldness, and I just really enjoyed your talk. So thanks for taking a few minutes to join us.
You were in Nashville.
I was in Nashville, yeah, where they told us just a month before there had been 3 feet of water in that Wild Horse Saloon. It wasn't quite a saloon like I've ever seen, but a big hall. And that 1 in 1,000 year storm was a perfect, introduction to the gathering that we had with our fearless leader, Al Gore, for the last couple of days. And lots of great speakers. Larry Schweiger was one of them. I did an interview with him, but we're going to save that till next week since you were kind enough to join us live. So let's start with just the most recent news. Yesterday, you probably have been writing about the fact that not much progress was made in that meeting with the president.
Yeah, well, the president had a big meeting with about two dozen senators. People may not remember, the House of Representatives passed a pretty moderate, but still a strong energy and climate bill.
Over a year ago, June 25th, I was in Washington, D.C. that day. The bars were crowded with a lot of environmentalists. It was also the day Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett died, so it did get bumped off the top of the news. But it did,
and I, you know, and like many things that the House passes, it kind of just sits in the Senate. And, you know, we have this 60-vote supermajority extra-constitutional requirement, which gives a tremendous amount of power to minorities. And, you know, the minority members, and, you know, they're not in a mood to compromise. I mean, you know, look, they're not even willing to extend unemployment insurance.
You mean the party of no? The party of no?
The party of no, Groucho Marx song, whatever it is, I'm against it.
But what are they for? That's what I want to know.
Well, I think anything that hurts the economy or makes Barack Obama look worse, I think, is what they're for. They, you know, have publicly stated that they don't want Obama to be seen as a, you know, bipartisan, you know, cross the aisle solution solver, and so they're willing to bite off their nose to spite their face. And so even though, you know, several members have previously supported putting a price on carbon, or even just an even modest effort to do that just in the electric utility sector, they now all sing in unison from the same, you know, talking points that somehow putting a price on pollution is an energy tax, and that it would somehow, that global warming isn't a big deal and we don't need to do anything about it. So it's, you know, it is very frustrating. The one positive that came out of the meeting was that finally Olympia Snowe, the Republican from Maine, said that she would support, you know, action in the electric utility sector. I it's kind of at the point where it's about almost too little too late.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the question is, is there going to be any serious energy legislation this year or not. And I'd say, you know, we're talking, it's about 50-50 right now.
Where's Joseph Lieberman right now on this issue?
Well, Lieberman has been, you know, a champion on the climate side. He, you know, in the days when John McCain cared about global warming, they had the McCain-Lieberman bill.
Right.
And then as McCain drifted further and further to the right, so that he wasn't even a maverick anymore, Lieberman, you know, partnered with John Kerry of Massachusetts and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
And they where is he
were
now?
Creating a bipartisan bill, which in the last month or two, Lindsey Graham ended up bailing on for, I mean, I don't know. I guess that's the Republican strategy, is to pretend to go along and then pull the rug out from underneath the whole effort and then claim that it was never bipartisan in the first place. So it's
are there any Republicans now in favor of this legislation?
Well, I think if there were a vote, and there may be a vote, on a, unfortunately not an economy-wide climate bill, but something just restricted to the utility sector, we would get a few Republicans. We would certainly get Olympia Snow. My guess is that Lindsey Graham himself would probably vote for it, for all of his bluster now, and I think we might even get Susan Collins. But as you know, there are a lot of conservative Democrats who have kind of gone wobbly on this issue. Even, you know, people like Evan Bayh and Coal State Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia. So, you know, I think the president, I've been frustrated, has not been willing to elevate this issue with the public. And, you know, time is running out. We have a whole, the Senate takes a lot of vacation, so there's going to be a whole week vacation next week. And then they take a August recess starting August 7th. So there's only, just a few more weeks. And then they get, you know, heavily into campaigning for reelection, including Senator Reid himself is in a pretty tight race. So, there's not a lot of time left.
What is it, Joseph, what is it that they don't see that we see so much, those of us who are believers, if you will, that it keeps us up at night and we have a hard time looking our children in the eye sometimes? Is it just selective input? It's beyond belief to me with all the, I mean, 1-in-1,000-year storm in Nashville. Turn on the news, you know, 3 out of 5 days there's been some record tornado or hurricane someplace, if not in this country, then around the globe. What is it about that doesn't spell climate change to them? When it was, as you said, scientists predicted over 30 years ago that we would see extreme storms, fires, droughts, as we're beginning to see.
Oh, I mean, there's no question that scientists predicted this would happen, and it's all happening. I think people who read Climate Progress know that one of the problems is the media, you know, the media will report a little bit on what happened in Nashville, but they'll never, there was no major media story saying this is what scientists predicted would happen from, you know, putting more heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, which would warm up the planet and put more water vapor into the atmosphere that would come down in more extreme deluges. You don't, when was the last time you heard a major, you know, media outlet give that story?
You got to start making an exception there, because, Joe, I've been reporting on the environment, garbage to global warming for 13 years, and a week doesn't go by on my show, which, yes, is on internet now, but it was on Air America for 4 turbulent years, turbulent for me, funding it myself, where I don't make the connections between the storms and climate change and the extreme weather and climate change, and also talk heavily about the acidification of the ocean. Now, I would like to be on a bigger platform someday, and then maybe we get somewhere. But just want you to know that a few of us are out there making those connections.
Well, and that's why I think the people who want to know the truth, they can find the people who are explaining it, who are talking to scientists. You know, they can read my blog, or they can listen to your show, but as you know, people self-select the media that they get.
Right.
And if you listen to the right-wing media, you get this very warped view of reality. I think the other thing is, look, I think many members, if you had a secret ballot in the Senate, you would easily pass this legislation. But now with the Tea Party movement putting up challengers to even conservative members of the Republican Party, like John McCain, get ultra-right-wing challengers. And you end up with people like Rand Paul in Kentucky, or I guess Sharon Angle in Nevada, people who just have the most extreme views. So every Republican senator is now afraid that if they don't pretend that global warming doesn't exist and that you know, market-friendly solutions are really socialist solutions. I mean, look at Carly Fiorina in California. I mean, here's a woman who ran one of the largest science-based organizations science-based companies in the world, Hewlett-Packard,
right.
And she puts out this ad, you know, intentionally confusing weather and climate and attacking Barbara Boxer for saying that global warming is a major national security problem.
As well as her hair. She doesn't like Boxer's hairstyle, which is also just as important, don't you think?
Well, that's the entire trivialization of the political process.
By the way, then there's Meg Whitman, who is trying to overturn AB 32 in California, my home state.
No, absolutely. And again, another woman who, you know, used to be that people would be kind of proud of being smart.
Well, she started eBay. I mean, eBay is the ultimate recycling company, right?
And obviously very technologically savvy, but you know, to win the Republican primary, you have to pretend to be a Luddite, and I guess if you pretend long enough, then you fool yourself into believing the nonsense that you're saying.
I've got a lot of quotes that I wrote down during your talk. If I can just touch on a few of them that I really especially appreciate. I hope it was you. I took pages and pages of notes, but I think this is your section here. We won't change people's minds, but reality will. But how long do we have to wait? We don't have that much. Well, I mean, reality is changing. Our climate's changing. But as you said, there's selective, you know, intake of what we want to see or believe.
Yeah, I think that it is hard to change someone's mind. I asked the audience how many times have your mind been changed by somebody. I think that, you know, in the case of climate change, you know, it's going to take, the climate's just going to have to get worse and worse. And I think that unfortunately, it may, for some people, it's just going to take way too long. And that's, in theory, why we elect politicians to, you know, individuals. You can't expect every American to be an expert on every subject. I mean, it's just silly. That's just not possible. There's too much to know, from healthcare to global warming. So you elect your leaders. It's their job and the media to explain things to the public. If both the media and politicians fail in their jobs, then you're going to have terrible public policy. So I think, you know, we have to redouble our efforts to do as much communications as possible, but some people are not, you know, a large fraction of people are not going to be moved, I think, until the climate, you know, it may take another 10, 15 years. It is unfortunate, but I just think that's the reality.
You offered a couple of statistics, and correct me if I got it wrong, but it's worth focusing in on for a moment. You said every day we stall, it's costing us, did you say between $400 and $500 million, or did I write that down?
Billion. Every year.
Billion, did you say, with a B?
Yeah, the International Energy
Agency. Oh, every year, every year, not every day. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, but it's $400 to $500 billion a year.
That's a small chunk of change. Not so small chunk of change.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental problem is we keep building the wrong infrastructure. Rather than running, you know, building new, clean, energy-efficient infrastructure, we keep building dirty, inefficient cars and power plants and the like. And so the more, you know, every year that you delay switching over to the clean energy economy, you are literally throwing almost $500 billion down the toilet.
Okay, let me ask you about another one. Our climate is changing 10,000 times faster than it was in the past. I must have gotten that wrong as well.
Yeah, that's, you know, over the past 10,000 years, until the Industrial Revolution, the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, principally carbon dioxide, hardly changed at all. And even over the last million years, greenhouse gases have only changed modestly compared to what we are going to do in the next 100 years. So yeah, in the next this century, we are going to change. If we stay on our current emissions path and we don't take action, we're going to change greenhouse gases more in this century than we have, you know, at any time in the last million years. And that rate of change is what makes climate change so devastating. I mean, even humans who are very adaptable are going to have difficulty adapting if we get to a point, for instance, where sea levels are rising 1 foot every decade. And when temperature is rising, you know, almost a degree Fahrenheit a decade. And so, yeah, it's we are driving very rapid climate change and potentially going to, destroy the oceans and large parts of the arable land.
Now, if we could just take a few more minutes of your time, and I appreciate your staying with us as long as you can, and the show only lasts another 10 minutes, so it won't be too long. But I got more out of your talk, nothing against our former vice president, but then Al Gore's talk this time around, I thought it was kind of weak on solutions, which is what was Bill. That's what brought us all there. But at least it's always great to see him, and he seemed to be in pretty good spirits despite his personal problems of late. We don't need to go there. But the second day, your talk and the man from the Glover Park agency that handles messaging and communication for the Alliance, very fascinating. And I think most of our listeners probably are, you know, in the camp where they're trying to explain to their family, friends, enemies, coworkers, you know, a little bit more about the reality, the science of climate change. So you talked about messaging. You say we got a couple things going against us. One is a tough message. You know, people, it's not as immediate and tangible as some other messages, although there's plenty of evidence that it is here on our shores now and not far off geologically and geographically or chronologically. You say, I can quote you, I think we suck at messaging. Is that, you know, we environmentalists, we climate change graduates of Al Gore's climate project, or is it just that the media is not interested? That's part of the problem too, mainstream media. They, you know, short attention spans, and they, you know, go on to the next story pretty quickly, and it seems like they, as you said, covered this already, as if that means it's going to go away, if only.
Yeah, there's no question that the facts, I think, are clear, but, you know, the history of the human race and, you know, America, I think it should be obvious that the facts do not decide what happens. And I think it the progressives and scientists, got a scientific, you know, training, are often left, you know, with the impression that if we just make, you know, provide one more fact or one more piece of evidence, that someone's mind will change. And the fact is that isn't what persuades people. And there's a lot of books and, you know, 25 centuries of knowledge of what persuades people.
The other side is doing a pretty good job at messaging, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the other side hires professional message people like Frank Luntz to come up with words and phrases that will persuade people, and then test them in focus groups and polling, and then they get everybody to say them over and over and over again. And so they have a lot of message discipline, and of course it is much easier to convince people to do nothing, particularly if you can make stuff up, rather than convincing people to do a lot. And especially if you feel, you know, if you're the side that folk, you know, only says stuff that you can prove scientifically. So yeah, we are at a couple of disadvantages here, and I think that the scientific community has simply not figured out how to deal with this massive disinformation campaign. I think the media has been firing science and environmental reporters and reverting to this drama-driven, he said, she said, you know, sensationalistic approach, mm-hmm. where they would much rather have two people disagreeing rather than sort of implying that there's a half the scientists believe one thing and half the scientists believe another thing, rather than just a clear, unemotional explanation of the facts of climate science, which many of them think, well, we did that story a few years ago, so that's boring. We need a new angle.
You also, one last reference to a quote you made, I think you were quoting Churchill. He wrote a piece on the scaffolding of rhetoric. Now,
yeah.
Because I've been walking around Manhattan the last couple of days with my daughter, and she happened to ask, Mom, Dad, why is there scaffolding on so many buildings? I kept thinking of that essay, The Scaffolding of Rhetoric. What did he mean by that, and how is it applicable with this current situation?
Yeah, there's an essay he actually wrote when he was 20, in his very early 20s, that's an unpublished essay you can find online. Churchill spent a lot of time trying to understand how to persuade people using the English language. Obviously, during World War II, you know, John F. Kennedy said of Churchill that he marshaled the English language, you know, to win a war. And he had a lot of advice about how you are persuasive, using simple words, using metaphors, studying rhetoric, that I certainly would recommend anybody read that, and maybe I'll just repost it on my Climate Progress.
The link to that on thegreenfront.com site as well.
I do think that people who have spent a lot of time reading up on global warming science and clean energy solutions should spend as much time, you know, reading some books on persuasion and on rhetoric and public speaking.
Very interesting point. And just two last questions, all we have time for. Do you think that this oil catastrophe still unfolding is ultimately going to help or hurt efforts to get strong climate change legislation passed?
Well, before this bill, everybody was saying there was no chance of legislation. I think that the spill has made some sort of energy legislation more likely.
But what about that argument that, you know, the oil Gulf state, you know, representatives that were going to be doing some horse trading, you know, and say, okay, let us drill and we'll vote for your stupid climate change legislation. They didn't quite say it that way, but that, you know, playing politics with the planet, and that's not now possible since there isn't going to be a lot of new drilling going on for a while anyway. Do you think that's going to hold water, pardon the pun?
Well, there's no question that some members were planning this deal, as you say, to vote for some sort of, possibly vote for a climate bill in return for more drilling. Certainly Lindsey Graham felt that was part of the deal, and it's mm-hmm. part of the reason that he has sort of drifted off into this land of incoherent explanations for whatever the heck he
good
is going
to
do.
Incoherent indeed.
I think that at the end of the day, this is up to the president. I mean, I think, look, if there, you need 60 votes in the Senate. So if the Republican Party simply wants to make sure that the progressives and the Democrats fail, then they could do so. But one scenario is that we get a final bill after the election. And perhaps members will be more inclined to be reasonable then. So I think there's a 50-50 chance that there will be some sort of energy legislation. But of that 50-50 chance, maybe only half the time would we get a real price on carbon pollution.
Just a couple minutes left. If anyone just is joining us, I'm speaking with Joseph Rome. He is the fabulous, brilliant writer at the Climate Progress, keeps track of all things related to climate for us at climateprogress.org. He is also the climate change guy at the Center for American Progress. And I can't let this show end without making a plug for a contest that I am in. Only four more days left to vote. I've decided that the Oprah audience, Oprah's platform, could really use this kind of conversation. Don't you think, Joe? So
Absolutely.
I've entered a green show, the only one. If you go to Oprah.com and click on your own show, she's looking for new unknown non-celebrity talk show host for her new network debuting in January. Please vote for me, Betsy Rosenberg. I've only got about 1,000 votes. I need about 7 million more to catch up with the top vote getter, but a lot of the people with millions of votes, I have to say, are not particularly serious candidates, in my view. Lots of comedians up there, but I don't think we should take up a whole show with comedy. There's other places for that, like the Comedy Channel. I think, and I'm sure you agree, Joe, it'd be terrific to really share the green message with mainstream, you know, Americans, which, of course, Oprah has millions of.
So, absolutely. I didn't know about this. I'd be happy to plug you on the blog.
God bless you. And then you can hear talk about ocean acidification and connecting the dots between weird weather, global weirding, every day on the Oprah platform. So that's how we can work together to really make a difference. Thank you so much. And last but not least, you put up a picture of, was it your three-year-old daughter?
Yes, my three-year-old.
And how does that motivate you as we close the show to continue your very important work?
Well, you know, she's the one who's going to have to. It's our children who are going to suffer through the consequences of our greed and myopia if we don't solve this problem, and they're going to live through a ruined climate. And
not to mention,
so, yeah, I mean,
after that,
I'm fortunate. I get to work at home with her every day, but I think about what the world's going
to
be like.
Well, my daughter was just three. All of a sudden, she's 15. I just put her on a camp, a bus to go to summer camp for 2 months. So enjoy every day. They grow fast, as you probably are experiencing.
Indeed.
Thanks so much, Joseph Rome. Really appreciate your being with us to talk about the gathering in Nashville with Al Gore and some other great speakers, and pending climate change legislation as the oil continues to gush. Have a great green one. Stay tuned in to your environment, and please go to Oprah and vote for me for One Green Show. Greenality TV, the ultimate survivor show, as I'm calling it. Let's turn the tide.